important to not cut that short. So if I may suggest that given we are now half an hour or 20 minutes behind schedule, that we run the entire rest of the conference half an hour late? Some saying yes, some saying no. All those who think that was a terrible idea. We can cut lunch a little short. Lunch is an hour. So if we cut lunch to half an hour. Yes? Cut lunch to half an hour and then that cuts us back into time. 40 minutes, okay. I'll just ding a gong when I want to get you back into the rooms, okay? Thank you very much. Okay. Up, swap, next. we have Matthias Schindler and Neil Wilson in here, talking about libraries and specifically British Library. In the Stevenson Theatre next door, we have Mia Ridge. I don't think she turned up today. So Kajsa Hartig, talking about what the Swedish Wikimedians have been doing. And, sorry? Mia is here. Okay, fantastic. So Mia Ridge talking about the MCG conference from yesterday and Kajsa Hartig about the Swedish connection. And over in the Sackler rooms next door, we have Mark Hanel and Daniel Meachin talking about more academic publishing issues. Thank you very much.
Okay, much better, much better. Thank you. Okay, the topic I picked was building links between cultural institutions, libraries, archives, and Wikipedia, of course. And and of course, while this has a focus on technology, there is a legal, a political, a social component to it. And the reason for this, you heard it in the last hour, and this is the reason why I'm extremely grateful for Harriet Bridgman being here and not Coral, because Coral couldn't contribute to the cultural side of this talk. Could only talk about the technology side if Coral was still around. I think, does the company still exist? I think they what some things were bought, and never mind. Everything Tom said was extremely valuable, so I will have to spend at least 10% of what I'm thinking about just for digesting what Tom said and thinking about working with cultural institutions at the same time while we're disagreeing on some concept of copyright. And links is usually the weapon of choice. So my name is Matthias Schindler. I joined Wikipedia as an author in 2003. I helped founding the German chapter of Wikimedia. I was in the board of Wikimedia Germany, and I worked at the German National Library for a while in the Department of Authority Files. And this is mostly the reason for my interest in this topic, or vice versa. I'm now a full-time employee of Wikimedia Germany, and my job is to maintain and develop partnerships to cultural institutions, such as libraries and archives. And in order to do so, building links and building a model in which cultural institutions can benefit from working with Wikipedia is the crucial part. And in this work, we have discovered some tools to make partnerships with Wikipedia more attractive than previously thought. The starting point of every conversation, of every link, is usually the Wikipedia article itself. And most people look at this as an article of text, of information. At the same time, it has a huge dimension of more information, machine-readable information, metadata embedded into it, which usually is not that attractive to to the end user, but to the culture institution and to the developer trying to make sense of this information. For example, links, and this is a kind of link that leads to another Wikipedia article, but in a different language about the same concept or same person. These are just the languages in which there is an article about David Cameron. I hope it's the right David Cameron, because there are some of them. In this case, every link to these languages should go to a specific article in Wikipedia about the politician David Cameron, who is currently prime minister in this country. And the information is embedded in the Wikipedia article itself. And the information there is useful outside of Wikipedia, because it contains a proper transcription or transliteration of the name of David Cameron in a different alphabet. So if you want to know how David Cameron is spelled in Korean script, the InterWiki link of Wikipedia is a good place to start. So whenever I want to see what kind of search term I could use on Google to get a Korean perspective on some topic, I sometimes use the Wikipedia article, look at the term, copy and paste it into Google search, and then use Google Translate again to get a first glimpse, a first gist of the information. And there are multiple applications, and one counterexample to this application is, for example, the current state of Europeana, because if you enter Paris into Europeana in Greek script, you will get only Greek results. And the few 4 or 5 items that have been tagged with the Greek transcription of the word Paris. So Europeana as a European place for cultural heritage is actually not one Europeana, but it's 25 Europeanas in different languages. So the Greek visitor will get a totally different set of results, if any, for Paris than a continental European Latin script-based visitor, rather than the Bulgarian or Belarusian visitor to Europeana, as long as he doesn't use tools to translate terms and then to see what they all present. And the question is, isn't there an application available that could help to look for items, to look for things in your own native language without having to write down description files in 28 or 29 or 150 languages same time? This is a screenshot of a very early a prototype a colleague of mine builds at Wikimedia Germany that creates a multilingual thesaurus that allows you to look for items on Wikimedia Commons by using your own language. So if you look for bridge, you will get items displaying bridges, even if the image description doesn't contain the Portuguese word for bridge. At the same time, it helps you differentiate between districts and administrative regions that share the same name. So if you look for bridge in a different language, you will get more and finer descriptions and distinctions. You can try it yourself, and be aware it's an early stage of development, but it's basically a good tool that doesn't require maintaining a thesaurus by itself, but it's simply the thesaurus completely derived from Wikipedia data. Just by maintaining Wikipedia, we are able to produce something that is useful in the outside world if you want to expose your collection to an audience that does not use your language that often, or does prefer another language. The second tool, and this is always embedded whenever possible in Wikipedia articles, in the German language and also in other languages, Czech, and I think the English language Wikipedians are starting to use it as well, are authority file records. This is the snippet above is taken from the Wikipedia article in the German language Wikipedia on David Cameron, and it contains the authority file record numbers from the German National Library and from the Library of Congress and from a OCLC research project called WIAF, which is an authority file connecting thing, trying to link different authority files together. And basically, once you have this identification, the idea. You are able to properly identify a specific Cameron, David Cameron. You get different information that helps to identify him in different contexts. So whenever there is an article about, like there's a school book or something about the young David Cameron, you can use, for example, the date of birth, the place of birth, to identify if it's actually the real David Cameron or a different one before he became a politician. The metadata, again, is stored in Wikipedia itself, and it's maintained by Wikipedians who help to keep this data useful. There is category information. So these are the starting points for a technical collaboration with cultural institutions. And the good aspect about this one is it does not really affect the problems you have with copyright, because in order to build links, you don't have to copy each other's actual content. This is the metadata. The content can stay at National Portrait Gallery as long as we can link to it. And linking is, it's not something second class or less preferably. Linking is the essential method of making Wikipedia a useful tool. Whenever possible, I try to repeat this mantra of saying Wikipedia might be a good place to start research, but it's a terrible place to end research. And if you think about this, the next consequence would be to say, well, if the Wikipedians take it seriously, they will try to make going to secondary primary resources in the internet as easy as possible, as convenient as possible to find the other information about the subject out there. The signal to noise ratio as good as possible. And usually the metadata, the authority file data, is in a good shape. It will help you get all the stuff you need, but only the stuff you need, and not something completely irrelevant to your search. And I'm extremely grateful for all the libraries who have been doing this for decades, and in some cases even longer, to maintain the data and to improve it, and then to propagate the usage of this metadata. This is a screenshot from a tool server project. A friend of mine writes, the tool server is a research project at Wikipedia where people can apply for an access to read access to the database tables of Wikipedia, and to develop their own tools to help Wikipedians do their job better, but to help other people around Wikipedia to do something with stuff in creative means. And what he does is he's extracting the person data information, he's presenting it, he's aggregating it, and he's doing something that has had a good impact on the library community. And in Germany, we're trying to reverse engineer the German National Library's authority file, because it's right now under strange license condition, and we can't use it directly. But at the same time, there is a public definition how the record should look like, and we do have the actual data embedded in Wikipedia. So we can actually create data sets that look like the PND, that act like the PND, walk and talk and all these things, but aren't the PND data themselves. They are untainted, and we can do whatever we want with it. And the fun part is we do have authority file records about people who aren't in the original authority file yet, because Wikipedians tend to be quite fast in some things. I think I wrote the first version of the biographical article on Barack Obama in the German language Wikipedia in 2004, before he became state senator, before he became president, and it took the National Library 2 more years to create an authority file record. So Wikipedia had a two-year head start in presenting some data that could be used as an authority file data. Every time we collaborate with cultural institutions, we try to to think about means of providing better access to the collections. And one result is a file format that's called PND Beacon. It's the most simplest form of a description of a kind of a sitemap file that helps a cultural institution to present what kind of data they have. For example, this is the biographical portal of people of Saxony. It's a couple of hundred biographies, and all these people do have an authority file record. And this is a file format that helps you to describe where the content is actually are. The numbers are the authority file records. You know them because the data is defined as the authority file record, and then you have this called this line target, which helps you to create a proper URL where to find the biography. So for example, the second line is Carl Gustav Ackermann, and if you take the number and replace the in the brackets the idea, you get a full working URL where to find the biography of Carl Gustav Ackermann. In this case, you only need this beacon file to get a full understanding what a website offers. So they only have to exchange just a list of beacon numbers in order to be able to automatically link to a site only when there is actual content behind it. And Wikimedia Germany, we are lucky to have right now 40 cultural institutions providing these beacon files, because there is no copyright problem involved in this. They don't have to give something out, they don't have to clear rights, because the number is it's the only thing we need. And in this case, it helps to make collaboration easier and to help bridge the time until the cultural institution becomes ready to release content under a free license or the copyright expires and all the other issues are solved. In some cases, the cultural institution does have its own authority file that's not connected to any other existing authority file outside in the world, and we help to bridge this gap too by, for example, mostly manually matching and merging the data. It's a tool a friend of mine wrote. Basically, you get a line, you get information about a person, any information the cultural institution has, which is in many cases very scarce, and then you get a list of suggestions from Wikipedia articles and from the German National Library, which person could be, in this case, the one you're looking for, and then people are making a intellectual determination if this is actually the person you're looking for. If it's royalty, if it's head of state, usually it's pretty easy to make a full determination if it's actually the right person, and only if there's certainty beyond doubt that we're talking about the same person, we can match these information, resulting in a nice table that says the one you have, the person you have at your collection identified as is the same as anyone else's PND of this number, and it's the same as identified in the Wikipedia article. And the moment you have this strong link, you can automatically link from one site to another. When we worked with the German National Archive to make 100,000 images available to Wikipedia, this was the essential part in the collaboration, and the data is propagating. So the moment you start looking at pictures right now on the German Federal Image Database at the Bundespresseamt, like the press office of the state of Germany, you will find Wikipedia links and PND links, something that hasn't been there before. So you start at one place at a cultural institution or a state institution, and then you can seamlessly walk around these institutions when you are interested in more information about a person. If you want to see information expressed in pictures, expressed in text, expressed in source material, like a library file. This graph was the most astonishing part for the archive. It simply said that we were able to match 60,000 records in 5 months using 10 to 15 volunteers. They had assumed it took longer. They had assumed that they were unable to pay any price if they had given this assignment to anyone working as freelance. This is the graph looks quite funny because it started with huge enthusiasm and then it started to slow down. People left, and then we had to incrementally improve the software again until it became sustainable again. Volunteers are great in exposing flaws in software because they are volunteers. They don't have to work. They don't have to compromise with bad software. They can complain or go away, and usually it's better to listen to their complaints and then to fix the software. As a result, the usability of the software is better than what the cultural institutions had seen before, because they can usually just order their people to do it, even if they don't like it, as a short-term or medium-term strategy. It doesn't work in long-term, of course, but I mean, who can afford to actually think long-term? These examples are part of something bigger, and this will be maybe an essay or a book or something in the future I'm going to write. It's about what I call a data garden. A data garden that could be a bit chaotic or could be a bit more formalistic. It's a place where data can grow, can be taken care of, where data can actually evolve, where data can be maintained, where data can be useful to other people, a scenario in which cultural institutions don't release not just the actual content, we look forward to this one too, but they release the metadata information as well and help other people to create a landscape or create an environment where the interaction is possible, where people can walk around between different data sets more easily. This is not just the semantic web, this is the human element of the semantic web. And there's a counterexample to the data garden. It's the data graveyard, where data come to the final rest. And it's my impression that we have already enough data graveyards out there in the world. And every time I speak to cultural institutions, including Europeana, I sometimes ask them, do you want to be a data graveyard, or do you want to be a data garden? Do you want to be a place where there is static information dumped and where people can come to mourn or to remember the data when it was still alive? And many cultural institutions doesn't seem to have fully answered the question for themselves, whether they want the data to be have a purpose on its own and purpose for others as well. The things we're looking forward, and I'm trying to cut this a bit short for more Q&A and feedback from you, is bibliographic data. We haven't done much of this bibliographic data itself right now on Wikipedia. This is going to change. We haven't started a project yet where Wikipedians are given full read-write access to the authority files at libraries, because usually they know better in some cases these days, and can be a valuable part in just cutting short the lines of communication for right now. We are just communicating errors, and then it takes months for the data to be corrected, when it could be just hours or minutes, because we seem to know in these cases where Wikipedians are familiar enough with the data just to fix it themselves. We started with focusing on people because this concept is well understood. A person is usually well-defined, there is a clear end to it, whereas other terms, such as subject headings, are a bit blurry. They seem to be differing over time and over continental or cultural institutions. So when you talk about a specific person, it's unique, and everybody understands what this is about. And the last thing is, we want to deploy
closer.
Oh, much better. Sorry. We want to deploy brothers and sisters of Beacon, of the Beacon file, to other concepts and models like ISBN beacon, Library of Congress beacon, because we feel that this extremely powerful tool, the authority file, is still used in too many cases just inside the library and not outside the library. It's not used currently in newspapers. It's not used on standard websites. It's not used on social networks. For better or worse, in the future, Facebook could become an authority file, but I'm not sure if I like this perspective. The beacon file as a quite simple tool, leaving no excuse for not deploying it because of its simplicity, is a good way to start a conversation and then to lead to something that could enable Tom to come to a conference next year and saying, look, this was the first bad day and now this is our second honeymoon, or this is the cultural collaboration, using the actual content in a way that satisfies anyone. You can see on this slide, this is a template in Wikipedia, which is just a first glimpse of what we could expect with using bibliographic data. It's basically we're starting our own bibliographic database, and you just need these days this line in order to make a proper citation to a book in Wikipedia. You don't have to repeat the information again, and it would help you to enrich it, to maybe use the Ferber FRBR model to find different incarnations of a book. There is a prototype for a bibliographic database next to Wikipedia, and Eric Möller, the deputy CEO of Wikimedia, has expressed interest and support for a data commons project, which could host bibliographic data as well. I hope so, at least. But this is something we're trying to maintain to see where is the place where a library could start saying, look, here's a list of all the books we have. Here's the list of the availability of the book. Where's the geographic awareness of modern browsers, taking into account that every time you click on an ISBN, you're not giving a stupid and dumb list of all cultural institutions in the world supporting the ISBN, which is pointless, because I'm in London right now. I don't want to know if this book is available in Karlsruhe, as long as there is a local library here giving me access to the book I want to see, or if there is a project, if there is a website like Google Book Search or Europeana providing the book online, hopefully without any IP restriction to the country I'm right now in. So instead of this static dumb list, I want to see a smarter list that takes into account where the person right now is, if he wants to share this information, that tries to take into account if the book is actually available. This list contains libraries, it contains rare bookstores, used bookstores, and it contains ordinary bookstores. And depending on the urgency, depending on your needs, it would be perfectly valid to get the information that a certain book is in a bookstore right now next to you and not in a library, if you actually need to look up just one line, or if you want to have this book no matter what the costs are. And this could be just one more link, one more bridge of data, one more connection between Wikipedia and cultural institutions, especially those who aren't willing yet to share the actual data, or who can't, regardless of their intention and their willingness to cooperate. Thank you. Two microphones here. Are there any questions, comments?
Thanks for that. I've say one of my criticisms of Wikipedia is how bad it is at the semantic web, really. You'd find the article of David Cameron, as you had the example, probably has information on his children or books he'd written within the same page, rather than being a separate URL that could be used in the semantic web. I was quite interested in the work you've been doing, but I noticed it sort of it duplicates work such as projects such as DBpedia or Freebase, where they're also parsing Wikipedia for that. How does your project relate back to those?
Lots of the DBpedia people are in Leipzig, at the University of Leipzig, and of course, they right now using Wikipedia, they're extracting information from the templates in Wikipedia. They are building upon that, and we listen to them. And at the same time, there is the Semantic Media Wiki group, which is providing an extension to Wikipedia, the Media Wiki software, allowing us to store relations in Wikipedia to identify what the relation actually is. If there is a link from David Cameron to something else, just to express what the relation is actually. If he was born in, if he currently lives in, if he whatever. And it's an ongoing thing. And Wikimedia was lucky to be part in an consortium of an EU research project. It started just 2 months ago. That will have a component and will maybe using Semantic Media Wiki and other tools to solve some questions. So the research project is actually about knowledge diversity, but in order to determine the diversity and to access it and to make it able to be processed, it's usually a good thing to have it machine readable by using tools like Semantic Media Wiki. I can give you a link. That's the EU. It's running for 3 years, so don't expect anything in a very short run. Please expect something in the next year. It's an extremely important step for Wikimedia Germany, because it's the first time there is EU funding available for this kind of work for us, and this is the first time for us. So we're looking really forward to create the institutional background to actually be able to engage to. That's the 30-minute mark. It's not a telephone. It's just saying, telling me that I ran out of time. I should have stopped the talk by now. So luckily, we have already entered the Q&A.
Just another question there. That work you've done matching up the beacon information, is that available in say RDF OWL same as tags or something that could be used in the semantic web?
The beacon format was created intentionally simplified, and we actually deliberately choose a text file to teach people a lesson against over complex file formats that are completely waste of time if you want to serve just one purpose. Yes, I know the promise of the semantic web, I know the promise of RDF, but in this case, just a plain text file does its work, and anything else like starting to put the information into brackets and text is simply, it's pointless. Parsing XML, parsing this information is taking more time than just actually getting an understanding what the content is about. And then, please, if you ever look into RDF, if you're not already lost to the RDF, please look at alternatives. Text files can be sufficient in many cases. From what I hear from the cultural institutions, everything that takes longer than 30 minutes to deploy will take administrative approval in these things. And in many cases, we are able to deploy Beacon in 30 minutes, so it didn't come above the radar of anyone controlling your time. So we can infiltrate the cultural institutions by just talking to one technician instead of having get formal approval to something. And this is the reason why Beacon had been so effective and so successful so far.
Would you be willing now to spend that 30 minutes to put the data you have as a combined project onto the semantic web is really the question, would you be willing to put back into the Commons this work you've done?
You can take the data for every purpose you want. If you want to convert it into other formats, please do. But it's up to you. The data is out there. It's these are just the files, and they are just plain text, and you can access them, and you can do whatever you want. If you want to convert them into XML, please do. But I actively discourage people from doing something in a more complex fashion than actually required. But as a, if you have a success, I'm willing to admit.
Hello, thank you very much for your talk. It's really interesting, and I'm not a technician, but I think I picked up some quite interesting things from it, so thank you for making it accessible as well. An issue that we're talking or starting to talk a little bit about Q is whether or not we invest in DBpedia in terms of our content and making it more linkable and accessible. And I think one of the issues for us is, in terms of the value that that we get back from that investment, is who else is doing it, and how seriously are those organisations taking it? Because it seems to me that unless there's a sort of, not a critical mass by any sense, but unless there's some sort of key organisations, institutions who are willing to kind of start off that on that journey together, which will then hopefully sort of bring other people in at a later stage, that it might not be an investment we can justify in terms of public value at this stage. So my question is, how seriously is Wikipedia taking DBpedia? I had a couple of conversations with delegates yesterday, one of which works for the BBC, and it seems to be something very much on their radar, for instance. What do you think is sort of next in this?
I think it seems worth noting that DBpedia is a fully independent project that we have no control over. Personally, I really love what they are doing, because this is something, A, we are not doing right now, and B, what I think we should be doing. But that's something that we can sort over. From what I see, spending time with DBpedia is worth every minute. Mm-hmm. And if you do it in a fashion that doesn't put any kind of content license restrictions on the data that gets produced, it serves and it helps anyone else who's around DBpedia. It's actively on the web. On the other hand, in many cases, there are easier steps cultural institutions can take, and they sometimes look so simple, but they are so often overlooked as well. For example, create stable URLs for your cultural items. That would be the first slide in any kind of usability talk. It would be any kind of first thing to do. But Wikipedians wandering around the web looking for high-value websites where to link to often stumble in finding a link they can actually use and put into the Wikipedia article. Mm. There are some Wikipedians, I mean, one or two, I heard them. One guy had to reverse engineer the method of creating stable links to objects from the British Museum because Wikipedians were unable to link to these sites. There was high quality content we wanted to link to, and we couldn't. But they're a tiny bit more stable, or all right. So this is the first thing. So create stable URLs. Make your content slightly more accessible. It doesn't have to be semantic. It doesn't have to be machine readable. It just has to be more stable. We don't come to your house and throw in stones if the link turns out to be unstable in the end. But we really appreciate any effort that helps to make your site accessible. And we think that stable URLs serve a purpose. For example, you have to imagine a web crawler like the Google bot or any other bot like a dumb, blind, and deaf person who is unable to follow artificially complex web links, dynamically linked, complex linked, and all these things. So if you create stable URLs, you will get a big plus in search engines too. You will be able to get more traffic from people looking for things on the web rather than looking for content on your site when they already know that there's something around. If you have questions, please talk to me, talk to my colleagues here. If you have experience on DBpedia on a specific project, please share the experience because it could help other institutions.
Thank you. Thank you very
There's a tool at Wikipedia that helps you in these cases, and it's basically a back search. It's in the toolbox, special pages. Oops. External links. Using this syntax, you can access all the external web links going from Wikipedia to another site. This page is open to the public. Anyone can use it, and you can get the first claims which links might be broken. This doesn't apply, unfortunately, to the links we create using templates. But if your site structure changes in a predictable fashion, it could mean that we only have to adjust a tiny bit of the template to make the links work again. But in any case, this could help you. Now, of course, you can, as a cultural institution, if you change your URL structure, you can look at the HTTP log from your web servers and see which links are now 404, which are now missing, and then creating problems. Going back to the referrer information, seeing which Wikipedia page contains outdated links. So you can actively maintain this information and give feedback if something breaks. If you don't do anything, people will start to notice anyway and might just get rid of the links, removing them as a bad choice or updating them if they have the time and the sense that they can actually do it. The more time you invest in this, it could mean that the more results you get. I'm really running out of time because there's a second speaker. If this was a presentation only to Wikipedians, I would have given it more emphasis in saying, please create more templates, please do it. But from what I know, I'm quite confident that all the institutions who have predictable URLs are most likely already to have these templates, rather than there are more cultural institutions here who do not yet have reasonably stable URLs right now. But you're absolutely right. Wikipedians can do something right now, and there's an example of extremely good work being done. So again, thank you, and I will be around here, and I wish you all the best for the conference and your actual work.
Okay? Fine. Hi. I'm Neil Wilson. I'm head of an area called Metadata Services at the British Library. And Liam asked me here a little bit earlier this week to give a few minutes about the British Library's new strategy to open up some of its bibliographic metadata. And I'm assuming everybody's happy with the word metadata. Yeah? Bibliographic? Basically, information about resources that may be found in libraries, etc. Okay, a little bit of background. First of all, the British Library. Hopefully, again, most of you have heard of the British Library. Not too far up the road, origins in this very building complex. We receive copies of material published in UK and Ireland. We also develop some considerable collections of material published overseas. And we have now well over 150 million items in the collections in most languages, adding 3 million items a year or so. 40 million books. Well, you can read the figures yourself. You can read them on the website, for that matter. But one of the other things we do, quite importantly, is also operate a what's called a document supply operation. We lend material via another part of the library. So we've got the St. Pancras area, where we have the reading rooms, etc. And we have an area based up at Boston Spa in near Wetherby in West Yorkshire, which handles all the lending collections. So that's just a little bit of context. My area is an area, as I say, called Metadata Services. We deal with the information about the collections in the sense of the descriptions of the books and serials, maps, etc., etc. And this has an origin which actually dates back further than the British Library itself, which was founded in 1973, to something called the British National Bibliography Limited. And this was originally a service to the national and international library community. And we, throughout this period of time, and it's, as you probably have guessed, you know, 60 years this year, our diamond anniversary, we have been providing those services through all the different changes in technology. Ironically, one of the ones that's persisted throughout that time is the print, which we are still persisting with. I think we may be going over to PDF next year. So. And as you can see there is one of our ancestors, our library ancestors. As you can see, some of us still wear tweed jackets, but we probably stopped smoking pipes and things like that. Okay, so why do people actually want this stuff? Why do people actually value bibliographic metadata? Well, libraries use it to reduce the time and effort involved in actually cataloging books. We actually use it also to promote information about what we've got in our collections. Similarly, publishers are interested in using some of the metadata that we create to assist them in disseminating information about the availability of their own publications in order to generate sales. Library users obviously value it from the point of view of actually managing to find things. You know, using all these collections we've got, there 150 million items, well, we need to navigate them. And increasingly, the descriptive metadata that is out there relating to books is useful to consumers in trying to identify things they want to buy themselves. You know, think of Amazon. So the thing is that the library world, the metadata in the library world, has evolved really from the traditional catalog card, which again, probably many of you are familiar with. But we've got a changing information landscape, as many of you know. We were mentioning the semantic web a little bit earlier on. And this is a much more dynamic model. The traditional metadata involved in libraries is very, very static, very, very linear. It's effectively a document read from top to bottom. And the world of the semantic web is a much more dynamic and reactive world. And rather than it being an end in itself, as a catalog record might be, i.e. you do your search and you end up in a catalog record, the world of the semantic web is really beginning to challenge that kind of thinking and really sees metadata really as a jumping off point, somewhere from which you can then go on. So we've got this changing world, and being librarians, we're interested in the information landscape. In the public sector as a whole, in the UK, apart from the cuts agenda that we've all heard of again in recent weeks, there's been an increasing interest in government in opening up metadata, opening up data from publicly funded organisations. And the web itself has really accelerated this development of this collaboration culture, which again is something, again, as Wikimedians, you'll all be very, very familiar with. Further to that, the idea of information being as freely available and as free as the internet itself. So many arguments have been advanced, and I'm not expecting you to kind of read these all from top to bottom, but basically say, you know, it shows there's a lot of them, why we should be offering up more metadata free of charge. Both as a benefit for the state, but also as a benefit for the organization itself. And in 2009, you saw the government actually promoting this via this document called Putting the Frontline First, Smarter Government, which was requiring a majority of government-published metadata to be reusable linked data by June 2011. So as we are publicly funded, we are interested in this as well. So changing landscape, changing expectations from Department of Culture, Media and Sport, who are our funders. Okay, libraries and librarians, equally changing perceptions. And these are a few comments I've actually gleaned from conferences and other events I've been at in the last few years. And I think the idea of us being book jailers, even more worryingly, the idea that somebody quite proudly happily saying, you know, I did my PhD with 12 visits to a library. And that was, you know, things have really improved then, since then. You don't have to go to a library at all these days. Is something that, as you can imagine, would worry us as an organization. Equally interesting, again, comments about formats. You know, we could be doing great work, but if we're doing it in ways that nobody else understands, well, you know, people argue, what's the point of the investment? And equally, again, if 90% of our users are no longer actually using our catalogs, what are we doing it for either? So really, we're having to take notice of quite a lot of changes out there in the world at many, many different levels. Strange enough, at that point, people are coming up with new uses of library metadata or bibliographic metadata as new formats, technologies have arisen to assist its reuse. People use it for creating their own citation databases when they're doing a piece of research, for putting together a personal library collection on something like LibraryThing. People, interestingly, are beginning to take the whole data set or look at the whole data set from a point of view of data mining. What can they tell about publication over hundreds of years? And interestingly enough, publishers themselves are coming back to us. Now they're beginning to republish things as e-books for descriptions of the material, which was originally published in hard copy, and now they're republishing in Kindle, Sony, other ebook formats. They want descriptions of the stuff to be able to disseminate them. So, you know, how do we handle this? Well, the world of bibliographic metadata is one of the changing areas that the library's encountering. And as part of this wider reevaluation of what we want to be doing to remain relevant by the year 2020, in this instance, we sort of set ourselves this target of saying, okay, what do we need to do? A number of the themes that came out of a recent document we put out called our 2020 Vision, which again is available on our website for people to download in full detail, a number of these themes are relevant to our metadata strategy. And these include the ones I've listed here: leading and collaborating in the world's knowledge base, enabling access, and supporting research communities. And again, you can read a lot more in detail about those. But if we're going to be creating a free and open metadata strategy, there are quite a number of issues we need to be able to tackle. We've mentioned at some points this morning about finances. And one of the things I didn't mention earlier on is that a number of our bibliographic services were actually either priced or had to recover their costs. Something like our National Bibliography. I mean, the clue being called BNB Limited is a pretty strong one. So at this time of financial cutbacks, actually doing something that challenges those revenue streams it needs quite a bit of justification. There's also quite complex copyright and licensing issues, which, again, we've touched on briefly. But also, there's actually something else, which is a reputational one from another angle, which is not only are we not keeping up with the expectations of government and the community, but when we are looking at giving things away or making things more freely available, there can be quite a number of different interpretations of even these terms, free and open. And free of cost is one element of that, but equally free of licensing restrictions, et cetera, I've outlined a few on there. And again, open, what do we mean by that? A number of our colleagues in the library world have put out sets of data, for example, at different times, but in the formats that we use in the library world. And people have said in that context, well, okay, well, what do we do with that stuff? You know, it's in MARC, your machine readable cataloging format. What do we do as normal humans? So the issue of being able to put out data but putting it into a format that people can use becomes an issue. When we do so, how do we license it? And again, this is a subject in its own right, and I can go into anything in a little bit more detail either over lunch or in the Q&A session. But very few people actually give free, unconditional access to metadata or content. They parameterize usually in some way, quite simply because of data protection, et cetera, et cetera. So that is something that we are having to do. Okay, so we had quite a number of choices to undertake here, and we are, as part of this metadata strategy, trying to deal with these following objectives: breaking away from library-specific formats, such as the MARC ones, I was mentioning earlier, and trying to develop these formats with the communities that are actually using them. Trying to adopt a bit of a multi-track approach, which still engages with our traditional libraries, but also with researchers and the linked data community. We need to try and get some attribution, but also find a licensing model which is most appropriate to the wider use of the metadata, and to come up with an affordable way of doing it all. So, what have we done? Well, you know, we have begun to create our data in new formats after doing a series of free trials with organizations, a variety of which we mentioned there. We've still engaged with our traditional library community by creating what's called a Z3950 MARC record download service, and we've hosted a workshop on linked data at St. Pancras with a number of key interested parties. We announced in August that we were going to be offering up large sets of our data, literally millions of our catalog records. And since that point, we've signed up 200 organizations worldwide, including people like the Public Broadcasting Service in the States, who I mentioned earlier, to our MARC Z3950 service, and have begun working with other linked data implementers about some of the challenges and standards and issues relating to licensing, et cetera. We've got an inquiry point now that can begin to field some of these queries. And we've begun to offer our RDF XML data, which is the format we eventually used, under a Creative Commons Zero license rather than anything else, and have begun to supply that data set to a number of different projects and individuals, including Open Bibliography, Open Library, and Wikimedia. So, finishing up here, next steps. In the next 6 months, we're intending to create a prototype version with embedded URIs to various resources, including DBpedia. And we will be putting that out there as well, initially a small chunk, and then, depending on the reaction, a larger set. We want to extend this data to cover some of the non-book materials that we've got in the collections, and we're going to be cooperating with GIST, or continuing to cooperate with GIST, to encourage wider experimentation with this metadata. And further to that, we're going to be looking at various other collaborative options, including working with the German National Library on their linked data initiatives. But most importantly of all, we need to find out then, after we've done all that, how are people beginning to use it? What are people doing with it? And can we also begin to harvest back some of the benefits from that engagement with the various different communities? So that was the talk, very, very quickly, I'm rushing through. And I'm happy to take any questions if there is any time. But I can go back and rush through that.
I was wondering why you selected the CC0 license, and if you also compared it to the Open Database license.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd actually went for an earlier version of CC with requiring attribution and going for non-commercial, but we found actually that was really a little bit too restrictive in terms of people wanting to take our data and mix it up with other things that were on more permissive licenses. So that's why we've kind of moved back into CC0. Open data, the open database, the issue there is one, I guess, between the difference between offering up records and entire databases of material. And we had quite a lot of in-depth conversations with our copyright advisors on this, on the nature of the kind of license you could attribute to bibliographic database materials. And in the end, we went for CC0 because that seemed to be the most appropriate one when people wanted to take the records and use them individually or in packages and combinations rather than using a database. There's quite a lot of technicality to this, and there's also an issue that I believe there's an EU... EU legislation doesn't actually allow you to copyright bibliographic data when the vast majority of elements of that data are actually effectively in the public domain, like an author's name or the title of the work, the ISBN. They're really, as a creative entity, we ended up with CC0 because that was the most permissive. And equally, it was saying that we are not asserting rights over that material. So it was really, it was a bit of a compromise of various different sorts, but there are, as we found with when we looked at the licensing models, many, many of them out there. And this was the one that seemed to work best in the end for us. I think our users.
Question down there?
I wonder how the Arrow project is progressing.
Arrow, I think we've contributed, again, a number of records into that again now for people to do some analysis on. I'm expecting on people reporting back on that. This is, for anybody who doesn't know, relates to orphan works or material which is suspected to be orphan in the sense of not having copyright asserted upon it, and is actually being run by, I think, the Italians, to which we're, as the British Library, contributing some resources. But I've not heard in terms of most recent feedback on how that's coming up. I understand that it's going to be reporting back quite soon, though.
Hi. You mentioned funding problems and conflicts with commercial revenue streams and so on. I just wondered, with a topic such as this, how do you make sure that the powers that be, both within the organisation and the wider field, actually understand that it matters, or actually understand, for a start?
Yeah, that's a challenge in its own right, because, I mean, actually trying to excite people about bibliographic metadata is a challenge, I guess, in itself. But I think you have to really then just go back and say, you know, what difference does it make? And try and use analogies and models that people can relate to. And a lot of people, when it comes to, you know, things like metadata, I try and use something like an iTunes analogy of sorts there, in terms of, you know, the value that people get out of something like iTunes, in terms of the, you know, using Gracenote and things, in terms of the metadata there. Really, you know, without that information, it would make it much, much harder to use your iPod, much, much of a more unpleasant experience. So just basically trying to get across the difference that it can make, the use of the metadata, and the wider, well, just purely talking about the commercial stuff. Either we could make money in a way by selling bibliographic metadata to cut the cost of people cataloguing in libraries, because they wouldn't have to catalog as much stuff themselves. Or we can say, we're putting this stuff out there freely in order that people can collaborate with it and us. And we can potentially then have, effectively, an R&D area that is much, much wider than anything we could have ever afforded to have as a single institution, because we can become consumers of our own data, effectively, in that world, and can reap the benefits of all this creativity and interest that can be out there. And just to use, you know, to quantify that one, the National Library of Australia, I don't know if many of you may or may not know, recently did a digitization project and was putting newspaper information into the public domain. Very interested. Well, it created a lot of interest amongst genealogists, people who were interested in family history in Australia. And they asked people to start correcting the digitized images that were online. And when they started looking at the feedback on that, they were beginning to get people working up to 35, 40 hours a week on it and contributing all that time and effort in terms of doing work on that material that they'd have never afforded to be able to do themselves. So I think you can begin to say that this might be effectively almost like putting the information out there. There is effectively some form of cost to that in a way, but equally the potential benefits coming back to it will far outweigh, we hope, the those more minor costs.
The National Library of Australia actually does even more than that with their newspaper project. They do a very similar thing with transcription of the OCR text, like the Wikimedia France presentation yesterday and the Bibliothèque Nationale de France. But they also seeded Wikipedia articles about the newspapers they had in the collection but didn't know anything about. And so they wrote a stub on Wikipedia saying, here's this a newspaper published in this town between this period and this period, footnote, back to their own collection. And those grew, and so they learned about what those newspapers were, and then they used the Wikipedia API to suck in information about the newspapers when you research them on Wikipedia, on their live website.
I think the most interesting things, again, are the things you don't know, the ways in which people are then beginning to take the data, run with it, and do exciting new things we would have never even thought of doing. And that's going to be the most exciting thing coming out of all of this, we hope.
I don't know whether I missed Matthias's talk, but a similar thing, which is what you said happened with in Australia, happened with the Bunda's archive, in that after their image donation, that there was such significant work coming back from the metadata that they actually they employed someone basically to handle all the corrections in their own databases to be able to handle the changes and updates from that. So, yeah. Well, can I thank Neil and Matthias for coming here today and speak? So. Yeah. And now lunch.
Yes.